Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy, pleased to welcome you to today's edition of All Sides Weekend. We talk today about books. First, it's my pleasure to welcome our new board op slash co-producer, Rachel Quimby. Welcome, Rachel. Glad to have you with us. Any mistakes are made today? Are Rachel's? No, not at all. We are a family again here on our program. Cassie Rose is back, WOSU's book critic. She took the hour off last time we were on air to go to the Antiquarian Book Fair in New York. And Kevin Griffith, professor of creative writing, English and poetry, and everything else at Capital University, had the nerve to teach a class at this time last semester. But he's flunked all his students, and here he is again. So thank you, Kevin, for being back with us.
Thank you.
We are going to have, in a few moments, a four-minute interview I taped yesterday on the phone with a writer called Claire Vey Watkins, whose new book of short stories called Battleborn is making quite a wonderful noise out in the profession. Claire is a product of the MFA program in creative writing at The Ohio State University. But before we do that, I just want to say good morning to Cassie and to Kevin. And Cassie Rose, just give us a taste of what you've been reading lately.
I will start with what we were talking about, James Salter, when we first got together this morning. All That Is, it's his newest novel, and his newest novel in 30 years. That's not his newest book. He has been writing short story collections, but his last book was Solo Faces, I think, about 30 years ago. So everyone thought, okay, he's coming out with his newest novel. How's it going to be? He's been a long-time writer. A lot of times writers don't perform up to par, and this is on par and also beyond it. It's typical to James Salter, beautifully written. He writes a world in a sentence. His characters are very well thought out. This one is about Philip Bowman, who served in World War II in the Pacific arena and goes on to Harvard and in the publishing industry in New York. And it's all about his life, his career, his failed love life. And that seems probably very maybe narrow or very just too much on a plane, like there's no great drama in it, but the drama is basically in living life. As I was reading it, I kind of thought of William Somerset's Moms of Human Bondage, which is about the meaning of life. And there is something in here that is about the meaning of life that I think that James Salter is touching upon.
What's interesting about, I haven't read it, but based on your description of it, it sounds like the gift of this writer is that he makes a day-to-day life, a quotidian life, really interesting, really riveting there. And you're talking about what they call the Great Generation, the World War II veterans.
Absolutely.
who are losing mm-hmm. now because they're very elderly. And I don't know about you two, but I'm the child of a World War II vet. I'm sure most of us of a certain age are. So this probably would resonate very well for many of us.
Very much, especially he brings to life the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. There's some beautiful scenes, wonderful scenes, fun scenes that take place in New York City. I mean, even as Philip Bowman is a young man going on to try and get a job in New York and talking to a very wealthy, arrogant man in a mansion off of Central Park. And just in that small moment, you know exactly how Philip felt and how belittled he felt or how overwhelmed he felt. And that's what part of the charm of this novel is. You bond with Philip. And again, as you said, Christopher, it is about the day-to-day life, and it resonates with you. And you can't forget Philip.
James Salter is a name that I hear about, but I've not read any of his work. And it's interesting. You said this is a brand new novel mm-hmm. called All That Is, but it's his first novel in 30 years.
Right. And you could read this novel and feel safe that you are reading the real James Salter, not that you're reading at the end of his career. So in other words,
he's still peaking, I guess.
He is. He's still at the top of his game. He's famous for a book called A Sport and a Pastime. And what's interesting to me is that is what they call out on the jacket of this book, that he is the author of that versus all of the short story collections that he has written in the meantime. A Sport and a Pastime is a classic, and it is in the Modern Library of America, and it is what he's remembered for.
Well, apropos of that, let me turn to Kevin and ask, as a professor and as a writer yourself, Short stories seem to be proliferating, collections of them right now. Why is this a good time for the short story in terms of being published?
There was some speculation about that recently, I believe, in some blogs, and I think a New Yorker article was written about the rise of the short story. And there's some controversy as to whether that there actually is a rise of the short story. But I think it came about because of the success of George Saunders. George Saunders, who is a great short story writer, he wrote Civil War Land and Bad Decline. That's probably his best book. But his book, The 12th of December, excellent collection of short stories, that came out in January. And that was a huge hit. It went to number one on the bestseller list. And that's highly unusual for a book of short stories. And I think that generated a lot of interest in the form of the short story. I think that and also the rise of the so-called Kindle single. People are buying Kindle singles, that is very short novellas or longest short stories, sort of a single shot reading you can get done in an hour while waiting. So I think short stories are on the rise. And I that's what I've been reading a lot of lately, too. There's a lot of really great collections coming out.
Well, speaking of new collections of short stories, there is a new collection out called Battleborn. It's written by a young woman called Claire Vay Watkins, who was a product, again, of the MFA program in creative writing at The Ohio State University. They are turning out some fine and published writers, I must say. And I spoke to her yesterday, and let me set this up a bit. Battleborn is a collection of 10 stories that are all set in the Far West, where she grew up, in Nevada. And there's a real sense of desolation, but these are not desolate stories. They may seem that way, but they really are not. And Claire has a very interesting parentage in that her father was very briefly part of the Charles Manson gang. He died young. He was not part of the murders or the horror show about that. In fact, he testified against Charles Manson at the trials. And he died when Claire was just a little girl. But that is a part of who she is, and she does discuss that in the first story. Here now is my visit taped yesterday from her office at Bucknell University with Ohio State alumna Claire Vay Watkins. One of the things that struck me first when reading Battleborn was your sense of space, of physical space. Now, I've never been to Nevada, and I don't know much about the area you're writing about, but I felt like I was there.
Yeah, that's sort of what I was going for. I wrote the book when I was living in Columbus. I'd grown up in Nevada, and I was really homesick for it. And so I kind of tried to, I think, sort of conjure up the place on the page if I wasn't able to go visit. When I got to Ohio State, I think that basically my whole experience of having grown up in the desert and it being part of a poor rural community was totally denaturalized for me. Like I said, I could kind of start to see it the way other people saw it, and I could start to get a handle for what was strange or interesting. Before I came to Ohio, I was not writing about Nevada at all because it was the only thing I'd ever known. So I thought, like, who would ever be interested in it? It didn't occur to me that it was a really dramatic landscape, and the people, it was just full of these really bizarre characters. And when I got to Ohio State and started just talking with friends and writing about it, people would say, like, this is weird. I want to know so much more about this. And so I was like, I started to understand the richness of the material, I think.
They live in great hardship, but these stories are not bleak. How did you do that balance?
Probably for me, the key was to always engage with the characters as individuals. You know, so that I wasn't thinking I'm writing about a prostitute. I would just think I'm writing about Darla, who works in this brothel, and what is she thinking? What is she up to, and what's on her mind? And I think if you can access that level of humanity in a character, they will inevitably offer these other dimensions. At least, you know, that's kind of how I see the world. If you get to know someone well enough, you'll be able to find these, you know, fascinating depths and dimension to them, and they won't let you write them as grotesque or bleak or just in a flat way.
You have a very, as I said before, interesting background, and you're quite open about the fact that your mother took her own life, just as you were writing this book. Did that make you stop or change the direction of the book, or, you know, that must have been devastating, but I'm wondering what that did to your process.
Well, I actually started the book a few months after she died, but I think it's, you know, pretty obvious that it's really heavily influenced by that event and that motherhood and the relationships between mothers and their daughters or sisters and their mothers was on my mind intensely. That kind of event is so seismic that, I mean, the to say it changed my writing is like goes without saying. I mean, it changed everything about my personality and the way I see the world. And I think it'll be a long time before I even understand the impact that had on me, but certainly made me the writer I am.
And your father died when you were very young. He died young. I think he was 40. I looked it up. And he had some connection to the Manson family very briefly. And that must be something that, you know, you could have probably never mentioned that and people wouldn't have thought about it. But there it is in your materials. And the first story, in fact, does illustrate part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Was that something you really wanted to get away from? Is it something that you don't like to deal with? Or did you feel you had to put it out there?
Neither, really. I didn't think much about anything except for writing a good story when I wrote about it. I just was starting to learn how to write at Ohio State, and I was I sensed that part of writing a good story was kind of there's an element of bravery in it, like that you should go towards the thing that you're uncertain about or if you're a little bit afraid of. So for me, my relationship with my dad and his story, he has this sort of like, you know, again, kind of like a mythic story, but I never really knew him as a person. So there's been like a tension there my whole life. And I just felt like the story that I was trying to write, which is called Ghost Cowboys, I felt that story demanded that I go towards that material. I didn't think about anything except for whether that would make a good story, really.
And that's my visit, part of my visit, with writer Claire Vey Watkins yesterday. Pardon me. She is the author of a new collection of short stories called Battleborn. One word, well worth checking out. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend, our book edition with Kevin Griffith and Cassie Rose. We're going to take a very brief break now and then come back and invite your phone calls to 292-8513. Back in a minute.
He looked around the room as if he had just landed from Mars and it was the first time he ever saw anything. Something was about to happen.
On the next Radio Lab, a woman teaches a 27-year-old man his very first words.
He slaps his hands on the table. Oh, everything has a name.
That's on the next Radio Lab.
Saturday at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
Watch a groundbreaking look at the epidemic of rape within the U.S. military. Independent Lens presents The Invisible War, Sunday night at 10:30 on WOSU-TV.
I'm Christopher Purdy. We're back with All Sides Weekend Books with Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like to know what you are reading. Give us some recommendations. You could even tell us something that maybe have been overrated. 614-292-8513. You can send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. You can also find us on Facebook. Again, the number 292-8513. Now, I had a chance to glance over at some of the books Kevin Griffith brought with him today, and I have to ask you about a book about a 550-pound agoraphobic former professor. Only you, Kevin, would bring something like that here. Oh, so go.
I'm extremely glad to talk about it. It's a book called Heft. It came out about a year ago, 2012. Heft, H-E-F-T, by Liz Moore. Liz Moore is another young writer, 30 years old, and teaches in New York City. This is a fantastic book. And Cassie and I were talking here just before about, hey, let's go back. Let's get off of this postmodern David Foster Wallace stuff. And let's go back to just really great stories about human beings and what they need. And here you go. Here is a former professor. He was a humanities professor. His name's Arthur Opp. He's pretty much the narrator of the story. He's an incredibly engaging narrator. He's 550 pounds. He's retired from his job, or he quit his job. He was forced out. He lives by himself. He's stayed in touch with a former student for the last 15 years, and the plot of the novel revolves around the former student has a lot of problems, and eventually she commits suicide and asks that Arthur take care of her son, Kel Keller, who is a Major League prospect, Major League Baseball prospect. And it's just a beautiful novel about how they kept up this relationship without really seeing each other over the years through letters. And it's a completely uplifting novel because he's able to sort of come out of his shell a little bit when he thinks that Kel Keller is going to come and visit him. They actually never do visit in the novel, but he thinks that Kel Keller is going to visit him. So he hires a cleaning woman to come over. And the cleaning woman is this 18-year-old pregnant woman named Yolanda. And so Yolanda moves in with him because her parents have thrown her out because she's gotten pregnant, you know. And so she stays with them, and they become this couple who sort of need each other and help each other out. And it's just a wonderful novel with an incredibly good narrative voice. I wanted to read just a little bit. Here's Arthur Opp commenting on how he felt before Yolanda. He said, "Before Yolanda came to me, in the 10 years I spent with myself and no one else, I had ways of consoling myself. Yes, there was food. But there was beyond food this idea I had an oversoul of loneliness, a connectedness among the world's lonely that I could turn to when I was very low. There was a delicious romance in being utterly alone, and I told myself I was nobler for it and that there was purpose to my solitude. Oh, there must be." And that's what it is. It's a very just engaging. It's not a depressing novel whatsoever. It's an engaging
novel.
Good.
I was going to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and how does the weight figure into it, too? Is the weight
yes, obviously.
Part of the drama and the.
Exactly, yes. Right. And there's an incredibly good scene where Yolanda's trying to get him to just go outside and walk about 50 yards to the park. He lives near a park. Mm-hmm. And just that scene goes on. It's protracted for about 20 pages of him just trying to go about 5 feet and then having to stop mm-hmm. because he's just soaked with sweat. And Yolanda's saying, "It's okay. It's okay to stop. I'm tired too." And this journey takes him almost the whole day to go to the park and back, but it's a major stepping stone for him. And at the end, there is redemption. And Kel Keller has a lot of problems too. Kel Keller, of course, is the exact opposite. Highly athletic, you know, everywhere, you know, a major league prospect. And eventually they do, there's allusions to that they're going to link up at the end. And it's just wonderful.
My curiosity is that's a library book. I can see that. And it's not mm-hmm. a brand new book. So how did you find it? How did you find Liz Moore, the writer? Who is Liz Moore?
Well, for one thing, it was one of the top sellers on Amazon for a while. It was one of the top 10 selling Kindle books on Amazon. And then so I saw it on the bookshelf at the library. And I also bought a copy. This is really rare for me to actually go and buy a book, but I bought a copy new for my wife for Christmas because I think it's a wonderful read for anyone. I just think it's a great story, and I hope it doesn't fall under the radar because it's just a wonderful book.
It won't now. Heft by Liz Moore. Our number's 292-8513. We would like to hear from you. Let us know what you're reading. Our email address is allsides@wosu.org, Twitter @WOSUAllSides. You can also find us on Facebook, but I like the calls, 292-8513. Now, Cassie Rose, you introduced me last year or a year or so ago to an author that I became obsessed with called Sam Savage.
Oh, he's terrific.
And Sam's out with a new novel. So let's get a little crazy and talk about Sam Savage.
Yeah, Sam Savage came out with this new novel this year, which is just dead on Sam Savage. You can be guaranteed you're going to get a cynical, amusing, blunt, commentating narrator.
What are you laughing at looking at me? Griffin.
Cynical and blunt. Yeah.
You're right. It is just, and that's what engages, is that it's his narrators are very seductive. So there's not a lot that happens except in their going back over their lives or what's happening now. And in this book called The Way of the Dog, it is about a decrepit old man in a decaying house in a gentrifying neighborhood. And Harold Nivenson is looking out the window and commenting on all of his young spandexed neighbors and their children, and also then looking back on his life and trying to figure out how he got to where he is. And his ex-wife barges in to clean up the house. His son comes in to try and get the paintings sold that are all over his wall and get a realtor to look at the house. But what Harold takes us back into is his life where he squandered his inheritance and became obsessed over a painter, to the neglect of his own work. And so he's working through this in his very funny, self-deprecating voice, and it's once again about failed art. Sam Savage always takes that theme of failed art.
Well, he's also, everybody's kind of curmudgeonly in a
very
lovable way.
So, yes.
I mean, sort of lovable, but there is a little bitterness there. Mm-hmm. I want you to just detour a minute and remind everybody about Furman, his book Furman, which I thought was brilliant, about the mouse.
A well-read rat.
Yes.
Yes, who lives in a bookstore in a Boston neighborhood that is being demolished. And so once again, you have this failed art or this neglected art theme. You know, the narrator is a rat. People think, oh, that can't be good. But it's hilarious.
It's hilarious. And the rat starts eating Pride and Prejudice and things
like
that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he starts and becomes very literate.
Yes, he does. And Ulysses and all of that.
Yes.
And
yes.
He came out after that with a book called The Cry of the Sloth.
Funny.
The way he writes letters to the writers who are trying to get published in his literary magazine, you're howling about these comments that he's writing back to them because they're not just funny, they're dead on the stuff that you wish that you could say. Mm-hmm. So if you want to get a refreshing, engaging, cynical, absurd kind of look at life, look at Sam Savage and The Way of the Dog. And that title is very pertinent because there, at the very end, there is a message and a way that he is lifted up into life, and it comes through his dog.
And I must say, if you look at the photograph of Sam Savage, it makes sense that he would be writing about reclusive, curmudgeonly artist.
He looks the part.
For all I know, he could be the most charming man that ever lived. I mean, and probably is, but he does look a little bit the part. We had a tweet from Arlen. She said, I'm reading The Gripping Hand, the sequel to sci-fi classic The Mote in God's Eye. Now, that's interesting because sci-fi is such a big, big business, and I don't know much about sci-fi. So if we have any science fiction fans who want to make recommendations, 292-8513, or you can tweet or twit or whatever it's called at WOSU All Sides, or send us an email. But give us a call if you're a science fiction fan or if you're not a science fiction fan. Are you science fiction fans?
I am not. And the only way that I get recommendations for it is I look for the Nebula Awards, their annual awards. And that's where I found Blackout and the follow-up to it that was called Close Something or Other, written by a really good science fiction writer that I'm forgetting the name of now, but she's been award-winning and won several Nebulas.
I was just reminded of something you recommended, but it wasn't science fiction, but it kind of the Hunger Games.
Yes,
that
yes.
whole series, which my daughter has become obsessed over.
Oh,
she went
really?
To the movie a bunch of times. The movie was great, by the way, I thought. But the Hunger Games was there's a whole...
Dystopian. Mm-hmm.
Dystopian. There's a whole... I don't know what that word means. But there's a whole multi-volume set of this that's aimed for young people that I think a lot of our listeners probably are familiar with. Kevin Griffith, now you have, let me see, a psycho meets an alcoholic real estate agent. That's right up my alley. Let's talk about that.
Well, again, another really great book that just came out. I found it on the new bookshelf at the Whetstone Library. And I'm trying to go out a little bit out of my comfort zone with Liz Moore's Heft and then The Good House by Ann Leary, because normally I read tough guy Don Pollock type fiction, yeah. You know, and crime fiction. So I went for something a little unusual, and this is unusual. Ann Leary, I never heard of her before. She's actually the wife of Dennis Leary, the actor.
Oh, no kidding.
Who was the voice of Diego in the Ice Age movies.
Rescue Me, yes.
That aside, she's a phenomenally good writer. And The Good House, again, has a really compelling narrator, first-person narrator named Hildy Good. Hildy Good is in her early 60s. She's a real estate agent in sort of the north coast of Massachusetts. She lives in a town called Wendover Green, and she makes a lot of money selling houses and showing houses that cost in the millions of dollars. But she's a struggling alcoholic, and this is not, again, not done in a depressing way or in a way to make us, you know, to teach us instructive lessons about what to do and what not to do as an alcoholic. It just shows her at her worst and at her best, and there's a good balance between that. And the other thing that's going on is while she's selling houses, she befriends someone who's moved into the town, Rebecca. And Rebecca is seeing a psychologist and then begins having an affair with him. And so things, you know, that's bad news. And then the complication arises because the psychologist gets a job in San Francisco. But if it comes out that he's had an affair with one of his clients, of course, he would lose his credibility and his license and his ability to be a psychologist. But she wants to really sell his house because his house has been in the town for years and it's worth millions of dollars. So there's a lot of that going on. She rekindles a relationship with a character named Frank, who's the town's garbage man, basically runs that. And they had a little fling when they were in high school. It's a wonderful first-person narration. It's exciting. Initially, it's kind of a humorous, so almost lightweight type of novel. Then it takes a very dark turn at the end I won't give any spoilers, but what happens ultimately with this affair gone bad. And then finally, everything's sewn up at the end. It's just a richly rewarding read, one of those novels you read to experience highs and lows and then feel good after you're done.
Is Ann Leary a first-time novelist, to your knowledge?
It says in her biography that she's written one other novel that I had not heard about called Scenes from a Marriage. And she also, apparently she's a part-time commentator on National NPR,
oh, okay.
I think. So
I should
that's
know
her
that.
Background.
Sorry, yeah. Ann, if you're listening.
But the Good House, it's a fantastically good read, and I'm glad I went out of my comfort zone with this one.
Terrific. The calls are starting to come in. We have Susie on the line from St. Louis with a recommendation. Hello, Susie.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I wanted to recommend a book called Scholar Mine, an Ohio State love story. It's a memoir, and it's just a beautifully written, tragic, comic, romantic story about this young woman's life, and it's just so touching. One of my favorite books that I've ever read.
Is it a recent book?
Yes, it's on Kindle and e-readers. Yes, it's fairly new.
Who's the writer?
It's Sharon Talbert.
Okay. Is it a novel or you said a memoir? So
It's a memoir. Yeah.
Great. Okay. Sharon Talbert, Scholar Mine, an Ohio State love story. What did you like about
right.
it? What did you?
It's Sharon Talbert.
Talbert.
Talbert. T-A-L-B-E-R-T. Just the way it's written and intertwined, and just the emotion, the raw emotion, the love, all the points of it. I just really, unlike the person that preceded me describing that other book, I can't really go into such detail. It's just, one would have to read it. It's just beautifully written.
Well, I do thank you very much for the recommendation of Scholar Mine, an Ohio State love story. Thank you very
right.
much for the call.
You're very welcome.
That was a call from Susie in St. Louis. So we do get around, don't we, with our show, All Sides Weekend here, talking about books with Kevin Griffith and Cassie Rose. What is Donnybrook?
Oh, I waited for the chance to talk about this book. This is an interesting book, Donnybrook. I'd heard about this from a New York Times review. This is by an author called Frank Bill. Frank Bill wrote the short story collection Crimes in Southern Indiana, and which is a great book. And Frank Bill apparently is very good friends with Donald Ray Pollock and a bunch of people from the Ohio State MFA program. Kyle Miner is also acknowledged in this book. But here we go. Here's the premise for this novel, Donnybrook. This is unlike anything I have ever read, okay? And if you know anything about Don Pollock's Knock 'em Stiff, right? Not right. A walk in the park or a light breezy
no.
read, intense. Well, this makes Knock 'em Stiff look like Pollyanna, I'm telling you.
Oh, my God. Can we talk about that on the air?
This is an incredible premise. Here's the premise of Donnybrook. Okay, in southern Indiana, every year, this wealthy man, wealthy landowner, has this enormous battle to the death. You pay $1,000. All these rednecks pay $1,000 a ticket to get in. There's 100 of them. He puts them in a big steel cages, and they just fight using any method possible. And who's ever left standing at the end of the weekend gets $100,000.
See, now that sounds like the Hunger Games.
That's the Hunger Games
for grown-up boys, in Indiana.
Okay. Yeah, but what makes this really incredible, though, is Frank Bill is an artist. I mean, he knows how to write. Listen to something.
You need to be careful what you read here.
I know. But for one thing, this is masterful. This guy has cut down prose with diamond-like efficiency. There is no sentence in this book, I think, that's longer than 5 words long.
Oh, I'd love
this.
Yeah,
is incredible. Okay, yeah. I'm gonna read you some of this. Okay. Yes. Across the ring, Ned's face was redolent of a bushel of peaches opened by buckshot and left to decompose in the summer sun. That is what incredible
Great.
Descriptions. Yeah. Here's another one. Angus closed his eyes, leaned his head back. Anger jackhammered his thoughts, creating pain. He survived their murder plot, had to get his dope back, implement what Liz and Ned had failed to achieve, kill him.
I think this is our cynical edition of All Sides Weekend books, which may not be a bad, because speaking of that, we slam poetry. That's exactly right. Yes. We have a Nancy on the line from Columbus, and she's a lady after our own heart, Cassie, because she wants to talk about Don Powell. Hi, Nancy.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yes. Tim Page sent me a book. It's the biography of Don Powell. And the reason he did was I mentioned my grandmother was from Mount Gilead, and I've never even been there. And I found it fascinating. She was a contemporary of Thurber. She was rediscovered by Gore Vidal. And he compared her, you know, the greatest, he said she was the greatest mid-century novelist, compared it to Fitzgerald and Hemingway.
And they loved her. They loved her writing.
The way the book starts out, this biography, it's really kind of spooky because I've never heard of Hart Island, H-A-R-T Island. Have you heard of it?
No.
It's the Potter's Field of New York City.
Oh.
And Don Powell, after all of the success, when she died, she was accidentally buried there 5 years after she died because she had given her body to the medical center in New York City, and her family in Ohio, I guess, just, I don't know, somehow they didn't claim her body. And so the description of Hart Island, it's a 101-acre island off of New York. People from New York that I talk to don't even know it exists. It's a 101-acre island, and there's almost 1 million souls buried there. It's the Potter Field of New York. And it's so that's how it starts out. You read that, and then you go back and you read about her growing up in Mount Gilead. And then she goes to Lake Erie College in Painesville, and then to New York City. And she just has this most incredible life story. I just recommend this biography.
Nancy, have you read any of the novels? And if you haven't...
No, I haven't. I don't.
Go.
This is what's so horrible. I don't read fiction.
Oh, well, do it. Make an exception. Go and teach. There are 12 novels. 6 of them are based in Mount Gilead and 6 in New York City. And you can't go wrong with any of them. Don Powell, I think she died in 1964. And she wasn't that old when she died. And what a life.
She did.
Nancy, thank you so much for that recommendation. We're delighted to have any reason to talk about Don Powell here on the program. We've got to take a break for about 90 seconds. Do not go away. We'll be back and keep the calls coming. 292-8513.
Support comes from Meijer, dedicated to fighting against hunger with the Simply Give food pantry program. In addition to customer donations, Meijer will give $1 million to distribute among the many food pantries in our communities this year. Information is available in-store or at Meijer.com.
Bill Hader makes his final appearance as a cast member of Saturday Night Live this weekend. On the next Fresh Air, we feature our interview with Hader. One of his characters is Stefan, the New York City correspondent who gives inappropriate recommendations for family entertainment.
If you're looking to get festive with your family, I've got the perfect place for you. New York's hottest club is Hey!
Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with a 2013 wellness series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's wellness series are at go.osu.edu/series.
Your annual support of 89.7 NPR News is our largest source of income. Your gifts make up the funds we use to pay for the news you listen to every day. It's easy to renew your membership. Visit wosu.org/renew or respond to our mailing by sending a generous check. Thank you for renewing your membership with 89.7 NPR News.
We're back. I have been asked to remind everybody of our email address, allsides@wosu.org. The phone number, of course, 292-8513. Very briefly, we want to just a little back on Don Powell, the writer from Ohio who died in 1964. Cassie Rose.
Well, about her biography, it's her life is stunning and something that could maybe resonate with people. At least one of the things that I think of about her is that she wrote many novels and she never went out of a first edition, which is to say she didn't earn her living by the novels. She was writing one after the other, critically acclaimed, loved by Bromfield, Hemingway, Faulkner. All the great writers knew what great writing was here, and yet she herself could not earn a living with it. She was poor, dirt poor, and living
homeless.
In New York and homeless for a lot of time. She had a son who was ill, who needed high care, and yet every day she kept getting up and writing, and her books were published. But that kind of a mindset to know who you are, what you are here to do, and to keep with it despite what was happening to you. And everybody else could probably say, why don't you just drop this and go off and do something else? She knew this was her destiny. You hear a lot of this in her letters, which have also been published, which is wonderful reading. And her novels are just the kind where they're very funny. I mean, despite this poverty and the struggle,
they're biting. They're dry and fun. Yeah, they are very funny. That's right. Don Powell is somebody really worth knowing better. Don't get me started. Anyway, we have a call from Brock, who has a recommendation for us. Hello, Brock.
Good.
Go ahead.
Hey, I just wanted to recommend George Saunders' book. Came out last year. I think it was called 10th of December.
Great.
Right.
Tell me.
Short stories. I don't know. George Saunders is pretty amazing. I don't know. I found him and he just kind of blew my mind. So I think people should read him. I don't know.
It's great when you discover a writer, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's really great.
Well, thank you very much for the call. George Saunders.
I love George Saunders. I mentioned him at the beginning. George Saunders is sort of inheriting the mantle of David Foster Wallace now. His latest book, which the caller mentioned, the 10th of December, that's a phenomenal collection of short stories. I would recommend that, but I think his stronger work is his first collection, which is called Civil War Land and Bad Decline. Civil War Land and Bad Decline, that's the title short story from that collection. That in itself is probably one of the greatest short stories ever written. And then his next book, Pastoralia, is outstanding as well. And George Saunders has this sort of running gag that it's sort of a theme that it's sort of the dystopian amusement park or the amusement park gone bad, that society has become one massive amusement park and everyone is employed in a certain way, but never knowing if they're going to be fired or who's supervising them. And so that's sort of the running gimmick in a lot of his stories. And I would strongly recommend George Saunders, too. If you're looking for the writer now that people are paying attention to, it would be George Saunders. He was one of the rare instances where his book, 10th of December, was a number one bestseller not too long ago.
What's his background? Where did he come from? Do you know?
He's an interesting guy because he went, as an undergraduate, he got a degree in mining engineering. He didn't want to do the usual thing and be an English major. And he now is on the faculty at Syracuse University. He teaches in the MFA program there. And he's been everywhere. He's been on Comedy Central, interviewed. He's a big sort of celebrity author now.
Mm-hmm. He's first on my list now. Thank you for that recommendation from Saunders. In fact, if you out there listening have discovered a writer almost accidentally that really gripped you, let us know that, because that's always a great thing to have happen to you. 292-8513. But Cassie Rose, while we're waiting for calls, tell me about Former People.
Oh, Former People is a very good, it's nonfiction by Douglas Smith, and it is called The Final Days of the Russian Aristocracy. It's the premise of the book actually is that there's a lot of literature out there about Tsar Nicholas and the Tsarina Alexandra and Rasputin and how that the monarchy fell, about the Bolshevik Revolution. Very little about the Russian nobility who stayed, who felt that they couldn't leave their motherland, or who felt that it was going to be short-lived. The Bolshevik Revolution would be short-lived. He focuses on two families, the Sheremetevs and the Golitsyns, I believe I've pronounced that correctly, and follows them through four generations from about 1914 up to World War II, what happened to them and the vast estates that they had. I mean, this is the inverted Nabokov speak memory.
I guess my assumption would have been that they would have been killed if they had stayed. I mean, but no.
No. There was, I mean, many of them were taken to prison and then they pleaded and then they got them out. But this is what's fascinating about it, is how they did live, how they were moving in a world where, I mean, they didn't have CNN. They didn't have the internet. They didn't know for a long time that this restlessness was, how dangerous it was. They didn't understand that the provisional government wouldn't somehow come back. So it's not the world that we live in now, where we are just very informed every day. And they lived in a country that had huge land, that, and they were way far out. So even coming into Moscow or Petrograd or going to the spa towns, they kept trying to find safety and didn't, because then they went into the Civil War. There was the White Army, the Red Army, all of which I didn't understand until I read this book. It's very easy to read, notwithstanding the Russian names, but there are some family trees in there. I stopped flipping back to the genealogy and just went with the fascination of this history and what happened, why it happened, why they stayed, and the unique lives of these people.
I'm just wondering, when you say about that, did you get caught up in their, since it's nonfiction, mm-hmm. did you get caught up in their personal stories?
Yes, very much so. Now, he doesn't develop them in a way that's novel-like, but you get caught up in all of these family members and how they are trying to make their decisions and where to go and what to do. I don't typically go for these types of books.
These are people who have never washed a floor in their life. They've never done
Correct.
Basic things that people Correct. Have to do to live. They don't
Correct.
Know how to do that. So.
Right. And also to think back, and this was just 100 years ago, yeah. and they had a feudal society. It was slave labor that yeah. was keeping these vast estates going. But it was also the misconception that everybody thought a democracy was going to come out of this, which, of course, certainly didn't, with Lenin and Trotsky coming on board.
Former People.
Former People, The Final Days of the Russian Aristocracy by Douglas Smith.
And I'm delighted. We have a call from Mount Gilead. Speaking of Don Powell, we were talking about Mount Gilead from Sonny. Hello, Sonny.
Hi. Listening to all these books, it got me thinking. There's only three books that I ever, as soon as I got done, said, man, I got to read this one again sometime, put it aside. The most recent one, the one I think I like the best, is Charles, I think his first name, Lamb. I Know This Much Is True.
Wally Lamb.
Wally Lamb.
Yes.
And it's just amazing, that book. It has, you know, flashbacks to other times and other people and all this stuff. But he had only written one other novel when I read this one. It came out a few years ago. His other book was She's Come Undone. And I read that years ago. I didn't make note of the name. I didn't even recognize it when I picked up this latest one. But when I read She's Come Undone, I could not believe a man was writing this.
Really, yes.
He had so perfectly gotten into the mind of a teenage girl that it was, I just couldn't believe a man wrote this instead of this girl. How could he do that?
I'm so pleased you called with that, Sonny, because he's an obsession of mine. And anybody wanting a good read, you can't do much better than Wally Lamb. And I think there are three novels out now. So thank you very much for the recommendation.
Yeah, and thanks for telling me about the third one. I'll go look it up.
Very good. His third one, I don't recall the title, but it is based on the Columbine shootings and the families of the killers and how they have to cope and how they have to try to live after this horror. But Wally Lamb, there's a lot of redemption in his writing as well. But he's a page turner, and if you're looking for page turners for the summer, he's terrific. Steve from Columbus has a recommendation for us too. Hi, Steve.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Yeah, you spurred my question when you asked about books that you just stumbled across.
Yes.
Some years ago, I was in the library, and in the library book sale, I saw a book, Hammerhead Ranch Motel by Tim Dorsey, and it just had a catching cover on it. And I read that book, and in probably 6 years, I've read all 14 of his novels.
Really?
I just tear through them, and they're the kind of book you'll be laying in bed with your wife and just laughing out loud. And he's got a main character named Serge, who's a serial killer, but he only kills bad guys.
Well, good. That's good.
He finds very inventive ways to do that, and it's very entertaining. And another thing to note about him is that if you've got any connection to Florida, Tim Dorsey used to be a writer at the Tampa Tribune. And his books they're all centered in Florida, and there's lots of details about Florida. And, you know, if you go there for the winter, or if you're from there, or if you have relatives from there, I mean, it's almost a lesson about Florida, but they're hilarious. And they're along the lines of Carl Heisen the other writer, the newspaper writer turned author, the name escapes me, but very, very entertaining, and you just can't put them down, and kind of the complete opposite of Tom Clancy, not technical, just highly entertaining. And
We like that. That's great. Tim Dorsey is his name, right?
Tim with a D, yeah. Tim
Dorsey. Okay, thank you so much, Steve, for the recommendation.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
You too. Thank you. The book by Wally Lamb, his third novel, which is based on Columbine, is called The Hour I First Believed. And I should have known that because I have two copies of it at home. And it is riveting as well. So we have Tim Dorsey and Wally Lamb as two great page-turning writers for the summer. And I'm delighted to hear about that. Who do you go back to, Cassie Rose? I mean, whose books do you have to reread?
That I have to reread.
But that you really are so turned on that you really want to reread.
I've lately been wanting to reread some of the classics that I feel like I read in university, and I didn't take them in well enough. So I was thinking of reading Carson McCullers, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. That's what I want to pick up again.
Yeah. Oh, The Member of the Wedding. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. How about you?
Yeah, well, despite the fact that there's a movie coming out, which I hate, but The Great Gatsby, I just reread that on a lark about a year ago, and I was just floored by how good the writing is in that book. I mean, read The Great Gatsby if you want to know how to be a writer, and then realize you'll never reach that level.
It's interesting you said that, because I read that in college, and I read it in high school, and I didn't. Mm-hmm. And I reread it a couple of years ago, and something struck me about how brilliant it was.
It's absolutely brilliant. It's just a home run, knock out of the park in terms of writing. If you just read the first two pages and the last two pages, you would be floored, I think, just with the writing quality.
And Bob is on the line from Niles. He has a recommendation for us. Hello, Bob.
Yeah, I'd like to recommend an author by the name of Robertson Davies. He's almost anything by him is really good. I've read most of it. And imagine he's got 10 or 15 books out there. Just fantastic writer.
Great. Robertson Davies, thank you for the recommendation. I appreciate that. You nodded your head, Kevin Griffith, on Robertson Davies.
My wife is a big fan of Robertson Davies. We have a lot of his books around the house, but shame on me, I haven't read any of them, but I know.
He's a novelist?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know the name. It's been out
British novelist. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you, and so you reread, maybe, if you're going to reread something, if you have time to reread something, what would it be?
Well, like I said, I just reread The Great Gatsby. I was just lying around the house. But the other thing I reread, if you want books that sort of stand the test, more contemporary books, I would say Motherless Brooklyn by Jonathan Lethem. That's a phenomenally good book about a... It's a detective mystery, and the protagonist has Tourette's syndrome. I would strongly recommend to go back and read that. And the other writer that I stumbled upon, this was a twofer. I stumbled upon this writer, had never heard of him, and I reread his stuff all the time now, is Daniel Woodrell, who wrote the novel Winter's Bone, which is a phenomenally good novel. About a young girl trying to find out who murdered her father.
And that did become a movie, but that was a great movie.
Daniel Woodrell is a great writer.
Yeah. Okay, we have a call from Richard in Fairfield Beach, who has a recommendation for us. Hello, Richard.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Yes, I wondered if anybody there had ever heard when Jean Girard read Member of the Wedding.
I don't think so. Jean Girard used to have a program on this station, I believe, right?
It was the most marvelous rendition.
Right. He is somebody that if I talk to people around here who've been here a while, they speak of him with great affection and reverence. I haven't encountered him myself, but I'm glad to have that reminder.
I don't know if there's any recordings of him left or not. But I do have one recommendation, though.
Good.
And I always go back to it. It's Raymond Chandler.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And he is so cinematic.
Well,
and you really don't need a movie. I don't think a movie actually stands up to his writing. And I often wondered how he got so eloquent, but I guess he had a English public school education before he came to the United States and went into the oil business in California.
But I think some got it and some ain't, you know. That's probably it. He was just talented, you know. Raymond Chandler, great. That's a great reminder. Thank you very much for that call, Richard. We appreciate that. We have a couple of minutes left, 292-8513, or you can send us an email to allsides@wosu.org. We're always interested in your recommendations. Alan is on the phone from Clintonville. Hello, Alan.
Hi, how are you all this morning?
Good, thank you.
I just found a wonderful book called The Projectionist by Kendall Messick, and it's about a guy who was the night projectionist at a local movie theater in Delaware, but he built in his basement a reproduction of the movie palaces of his youth.
Really?
And he had like 5 seats that he had recovered from all the elements came from demolished theaters, and he had like 5 seats, and he would show movies from the silent era. He built his own organ.
Mm-hmm. And the writer is Kay Messick. Had you encountered this writer before?
No, I hadn't. I found the book at a remaindered place.
Well, thank you very much for the recommendation, Alan. I hope you're enjoying retirement. Thank you very much
for the
call. Thank you. I want to come back to this because you two, Cassie and Kevin, and a lot of people, they bring in books by writers they've never heard of that somehow came their way. You bring in Kevin from the library, and I'm fascinated by how people find books or books find them.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I do is I just look at the new book section in Whetstone usually and just begin, look at the first couple pages. First thing is if the writing style puts me off, I just won't even look at it anymore. But I read a little bit into it, see if it's engaging. If it is, I'll give it another chance.
It helps if you love to read, doesn't it? Yeah. And we have one more call from Cleveland, from Michael. Hello, Michael.
Yes, hi.
Go ahead.
Yes, I read a book of Master of the Game called by Sidney Sheldon. I was very intrigued, and I read a couple more of his books, but I can't quite recall those books. But I do remember Master of the Game, and it was a very interesting story of a history of family that, they found these diamonds, and there was it's a very interesting book.
Michael, we got to go, but I do thank you for the recommendation of Sidney Sheldon. Thank you so much. Time to leave already. I'm Christopher Purdy, host of All Sides Weekend Books with Cassie Rose. Thank you, Cassie Rose, and thank you, Kevin Griffith.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your calls. Keep reading. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org.